for the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about bacteria. Yeah, I know. You wanted to talk about that for a while. Today's going to be your opportunity. I certainly have, because bacteria, they're exciting. They are the most abundant organisms on Earth. A single teaspoonful of soil contain billions, as with a B, billions of bacteria. That's more than the total population, isn't it? More than total population of people in the world. That's the amount of bacteria in one heaping teaspoonful. And, you know, we tend to think of them, if we think of them at all, and I'm sure you do as you wash your hands with that antibacterial soap, we tend to think of them as germs, insidious little microscopic dots that cause disease. Although a few species of bacteria are harmful to us, others are lifesavers. Most antibiotics originally came from bacteria. They can break down waste and return nutrients to the earth. They can even make old milk into good cheese. And there, you know, they help us digest our food. So you got to have bacteria. And where are they? They're in our guts. There's a good chance you'll find them right there in your backyard among thousands of other unidentified bacteria in the soil. And believe it or not, there are some scientists who, well, they're sort of bacteria searchers. They like to go into the backyard or into a field and delve into the DNA in these bacteria. It's a process called metagenomics, and it may be the key to finding all sorts of new and useful bacterial products. So you don't need to be in a lab to appreciate bacteria. Low-Tech is a fine place to start for the amateur bacterial ecologist. Bacteria leave calling cards all around us. They're easy ways to identify which bacteria are thriving and where. In this hour, we'll talk about where to look and what to look for. You might even want to try growing some at home or prospect for them right in your own backyard. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. We're talking about bacteria. Let me introduce my guests. Betsy Dexter Dyer is the Boyan Jennings Professor of Biology at Wheaton College in Northern Massachusetts. She is the author of A Field Guide to Bacteria. Yeah, it's got its own field guide, published by Cornell University Press. Dr. Dyer joins us from her home. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Dr. Joe Handelsman is the Howard Hughes Medical Institute Professor of Plant Pathology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. She joins us from the studios of WHA in Madison. Welcome to the program, Dr. Handelsman.
Hi, thank you.
How did Dr. Handelsman, why do you love bacteria so much? How did you get interested in them?
Well, they're fascinating organisms from a scientific standpoint, but they're also important to the entire world around us. From a scientific standpoint, I think they intrigue us because they're so unknown. They represent one of the vast unknown frontiers left to study in biology. They are important to us because they've really determined human history. You mentioned before that bacteria are the producers of most of our antibiotics. They're also, as you also mentioned, great germs that are killers of massive human populations. And so many life events have of the bacteria have altered the history of our own species. So both their positive and negative effects on the world are very obvious. What isn't obvious to most people, because we take antibiotics and we have disease, so we're aware of those effects, are that the bacteria really maintain the health of our biosphere. They're responsible for most of the cycling of nutrients and making nutrients that we can't gain access to ourselves available to us and to the plants and animals that we eat. So they make life on Earth possible. Mm-hmm. So they, of course, they're the most important organisms because they make the life of all other organisms possible.
Dr. Dyer, how did you get interested in bacteria? I have your field guide here. This is fascinating because, you know, there are field guides, I say, for birds, for stars, for trees, for plants. Now you got one for bacteria. How did you get interested in this?
Well, about 20 years ago, I got to go on several field trips with some expert field microbiologists who showed me and others how to identify bacteria in the field. And I realized then that if I could put together all of their rules of thumb for spotting their bacteria and all of their little tricks for seeking out particular habitats of bacteria, if I could put it all together, I would have a field guide. And I've been a naturalist for years, and I love including all of biodiversity in what I see when I go on a field trip or a nature walk. And so it's really been enjoyable for me to put it all together in the form of a field guide.
And like a great field guide, it has all these color plates.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at these pictures in the field guide. I thought these were other things. They're bacteria. I thought I was looking at something else on the ground.
Right. One of the tricks, though, is you can certainly see bacterial or sense bacterial field marks in your own conventional backyard, but the best trick of all is to go on a vacation or a field trip to a somewhat more exotic site, like a hot spring or a hypersaline environment, like a salt flat, and there bacteria dominate. There the more complex organisms fall away, and you see the beautiful colors of the bacteria and smell them and see their manifestations.
Dr. Handelsman, you sort of prospect in the soil for bacteria, don't you?
Yes, that's right.
You actually take a shovel out there and dig up the soil and take it back to your lab?
That's exactly what we do. We use either a shovel or a core, which is like a pipe or a tube that digs deeply into the soil, and we can pull pieces out from either shallow depths right on the surface or from greater depths lower down.
And what do you expect to find? Expect to find new unidentified bacteria or just something different?
Well, we expect there to be new species of bacteria because every environment that microbiologists have gone into has yielded new species of bacteria and new variants on old species. So we're interested in the cultured organisms, the ones that will grow in culture that will give us insight into the rest of biology, the rest of biodiversity of the bacteria, as well as products that they might make that would be useful to us.
Mm-hmm. And what do you say products? Do you mean more antibacterial products or antibiotics?
Yeah, as you're well aware, there's a crisis in antibiotic usage today because of the resistance that bacteria have developed to the antibiotics that have been the backbone of medicine to treat infectious disease. And so we desperately need more antibiotics, and the bacteria have been a rich source in the past, and so we're hoping that they will continue to be in the future.
1-800-989-8255, talking about bacteria. Can you find new species of bacteria all the time?
We can, every time we go into the soil, we can find DNA evidence of new species. But the beauty of, and the excitement, and perhaps also the terror of this field, is that most of those species can't be cultured in the test tube or on a petri dish. And the last about 100 years of bacteriology has been premised on the ability to grow bacteria on an agar surface or in a culture. Most of the bacteria in the world, and most means probably 999 out of 1,000, can't be grown in culture. So while we can find their molecular signatures, DNA patterns that tell us that they're there and that they're new species, and some of them are very unrelated to any species that we have in hand in culture, we can't get our hands on them because they won't grow in culture.
Can you still study them? Can you, leave them in the soil and grow them there? I mean, how can you study them if you can't grow them?
Well, we've been thinking of this as a conversation, and if you imagine that you're trying to get to know 1,000 people and only one of them can speak, you have to figure out other ways of communicating with the other 999. And so that's what we're doing. We're trying to find alternative means to interact with the bacteria and find out how they live, what they can do, what they produce in terms of antibiotics and other products. And one of those methods is the one that you mentioned before, metagenomics. With that method, we can study their entire genomes, all of the genes of the organism, without having to culture it.
1-800-989-8255. Dr. Dyer, give us for the burgeoning person who wants to take a field trip. If somebody said, "I want to be study bacteria in the field," what would be a good starter thing?
Well, everyone can go out to their conventional backyard. Now, I'm saying a backyard that has a garden with soil in it. And right now, could dig up a trowelful of soil and smell that fresh-turned earth smell. And that's the smell of geosmin, which is produced by actinomycete bacteria. So right there is your first odoriferous field mark that indicates a particular group of bacteria. If you live at the edge of a desert, though, or at the edge of the sand dunes, you have an opportunity to look at desert crust, visible manifestation of blue-green bacteria that are holding and stabilizing the sands there. If you live at the seashore, you can go out at low tide, and if you can smell sulfur in the air, then you have an opportunity, if the waves are not too choppy, if things are stable enough, to see beautiful colors of sulfur bacteria, purples and pinks and blue-green and black and white, all manifesting themselves visibly on the salt flat.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones to Chris in Naples, Florida. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I'm a retired plastic surgeon, and I'm all for exactness. And in your intro, you said that bacteria produce cheese, and I did pretty good in microbiology, and I thought it was mostly fungi that produce cheese, number one. Number two, the previous person referred to an epidemic of disease in cattle, and I believe the correct term for that would be an epizootic, not an epidemic, because an epidemic is in people.
Well, may I comment about the cheese?
Yes, go ahead.
Actually, it's a whole community of microorganisms, mostly bacteria, but certainly any cheese that has any kind of blue to it, we can attribute that to the fungus, one of the penicillin fungi. And actually, there's some white versions of the penicillin fungi that give us kind of a felt-like or fuzzy texture to some of the cheeses. But bacteria are very, very much responsible for some of our most interesting cheeses.
I learned something.
What about the epizoo part?
He may be correct about that.
All right. You got one out of two today, Chris.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, that's very interesting. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Sure.
1-800-989-8255. How do bacteria – let's talk about prospecting for bacteria in our own bodies. I mean, I remember years ago there was a great children's show on called Beekman's World. Mm. And I actually think he was the early Kramer before there was Seinfeld. It looked just like the Kramer character. Maybe they got him. Kramer got him from that character. And he did a toe cheese experiment where he showed kids to take, you know, wipe their finger on between their toes and put it on an agar dish and see what grew there.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, did stuff grow.
Yes. Including, by the way, some of the between-the-toe bacteria of a genus called Brevibacterium are one in the same bacteria as the ones that cause produce some of our smelliest cheeses, like Limburger cheese and genuine Munster. And it's not such a coincidence, because when you think about the traditional cottage industry of cheese making, whatever happened to be in and on us was probably most accessible to whatever milk was about to become cheese.
So that's where the similar odors come from.
Yes, that's right.
Toe cheese is toe cheese.
Yes.
What about what kind of bacteria, Dr. Handelsman, if you want to jump in there, go ahead.
Some of the most interesting communities of bacteria actually reside inside of us.
That was my next question, so I'm glad you brought it up.
Okay, so we have, of course, many bacteria on our surfaces, and you can culture some of those quite readily, and you can wash your hands and still culture them quite readily. So they're pretty hard to get rid of, and that's probably a good thing, because most of them are protective for us. But the really complex communities are in our mouths and our intestines. The human mouth has been shown to contain at least 400 species, and it may be even closer to 1,000 different species of bacteria. And they form this very carefully architected community. It's structured physically and in terms of the nutrients that the bacteria exchange and how they depend on each other. The human gut is probably even more complex. It's thought to contain over 1,000 species of bacteria. Both of these environments obviously are important to everything we do. They maintain our health, and when those communities fall apart, so does the health of the organ that they live in. But the big challenge in studying them is the issue I brought up before, that most of them are not culturable.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about bacteria this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Did you say the ones in our gut are not culturable?
Most of them.
Is that right? Why can they live in our guts, but we can't culture them?
Well, because we're not smart enough. But as a bacteriologist, you're reminded on a daily basis that the bacteria are smarter than us, because figuring out their secrets is quite a challenge. And figuring out how to culture 1,000 different species is a tough job. They may need nutrients that we're not aware of that are secreted in our guts. They may need oxygen levels that we haven't approximated in the lab. Or they may need their buddies. They may need to be living with another bacterium in order to survive. So there are so many different parameters that we could test that it's very hard to develop new culturing techniques, but that's an ongoing effort. Scientists are working very hard to figure out new ways to culture bacteria that have been inaccessible.
Yes, if I may second that,
sure.
I think the mixed culture techniques that people are experimenting with more and more are going to be some important ways to get at some of these bacteria. But those actually come out of an ancient tradition. Russian microbiology originated with a lot of multi-culture techniques with multiple bacteria being cultured together, one of the most famous of which is the Winogradsky column, which is a spectacular way to get a community of bacteria growing. And I'm glad to see some of those techniques are being revived and applied here, because Dr. Handelsman is right, bacteria need each other in these communities in some cases.
I like that. There's a bumper sticker there. Bacteria need each other. All right. Well,
and we need them.
Let's get a phone call in. Leslie in Monterey, California. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, go ahead.
Hey, I learned in a biology course I recently took that salt causes a bacterial cell wall to lyse or to break apart. That's why salting pork in the old days was a good way to keep it fresh. So how do the darn things live on salt flats?
Some bacteria lyse open in the presence of salt, but some are not only tolerant of salt, but require it. They have a slightly different internal chemistry such that salt does not burst them open, and those are our halophilic bacteria, salt-loving bacteria. And they can also, by the way, live on salted meats.
Ah.
Yeah.
Wow. Thanks for calling. That's
okay.
There's some pretty rough and tough bacteria, aren't there?
Yes.
They're immune to all kinds of stuff.
They exist in just about every environment we've looked at, so there is some group of bacteria that can survive just about any condition we throw at them. Although boiling is a good way to kill most bacteria, and we all use that in various ways to protect our food, there are bacteria that can live above the boiling point of water in hot springs and deep sea vents. So just about every condition has been overcome by bacterial evolution.
We used to talk about the archaebacteria.
Yeah.
But they've been separated out, right?
Yes, they have been.
We call them archaea now because we know that they are as distant from the bacteria as the third group of life, which is the eukaryotes, and that's the group that we're in, the higher organisms that have nuclei and often are multicellular. And so it was sort of a misnomer to call them archaebacteria because it sounded like they were just variants on bacteria, and they're not. They're an entire separate class of life.
All right, we're going to come back and continue this talk about life and bacteria and take your calls, talk about prospecting a little bit more, and maybe another little trip into the field guide. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about bacteria with Joe Handelsman, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute Professor of Plant Pathology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, Betsy Dexter Dyer, the Boyan Jennings Professor of Biology at Wheaton College in Norton, Massachusetts, and author of A Field Guide to Bacteria. That's out on the Cornell University Press. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. Betsy, you gave us an idea about what to do with a trowel full of of dirt. I know you hate to call it dirt,
no,
right?
No, soil.
Soil. Right? Well, my backyard's frozen at this point, so I'm not going to be doing that experiment. Anything else? Any other field trip we might take? Or when the soil loosens up a little bit this spring?
Well, if you're in an urban environment, you could wander out to any good deli where any kind of fermented food is being made. It isn't just cheese that we can be grateful to bacteria for. It's properly made pickles. It's interesting vinegars. It's interesting fish sauces at an Asian market. I think there's a lot to be done with an urban sort of a field trip. You can even go to a zoo and appreciate that pretty much every herbivore you see, there are just very few exceptions to this, that exceptions are actually interesting, pretty much any herbivore you see is a huge barrel-like shaped organism because it's a fermentation fat. It's very difficult to eat and digest cellulose and get any nutrients out of it whatsoever without bacteria.
How hard is it to make your own little agar petri dish solution set up? Or would it be better just to order one from a supply store?
You can purchase agar at a health food store. I think I'm not exactly sure what the health food store is carrying it for, but it comes in little packets. I've purchased it there, even though I can get it easily as a biologist as well. I purchased it just to find out what it would be like to do this as an amateur in my kitchen. And so to me, it's completely feasible to be preparing your own little agar plates if you want to.
Mm-hmm. And where do you incubate it or store it once you put your own little smear in there?
Wherever you want, because remember, as Dr. Handelsman reminded us, they live everywhere, all the way from the coldest of temperatures to the hottest of temperatures. So really, I like to think like a bacterium or think like the bacteria that I'm trying to get and set up conditions that I think might produce some interesting results. Could mm-hmm. be room temperature, could mm-hmm. be in some kind of chillier temperature.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Handelsman, go ahead. Do you want to jump in there?
Well, I was going to suggest an alternative to the agar petri dish. One substance that was used very early on in bacteriology was gelatin, and that's very effective, and most of us have access to that. But the other one, I think, is even classier, and that's a cut potato.
Yeah.
One of the first bacteriologists that studied pathogens, and he actually proved for the first time that a microorganism caused a human disease, was Robert Koch. And he cultured his first bacteria, actually from animals, on a cut potato. And it makes a very nice petri plate kind of surface.
Yes,
I have found that whipped cream cheese is really good.
Well, right. Pretty much any interesting spot of pinkish or yellowish growing on something in your refrigerator might well be a cold-tolerant bacteria.
How do you know that what's growing there? Can you look at a dish and see that it's a bacteria versus a fungus or something else on your dish?
If it's fuzzy, I tend to think fungi. There are some exceptions to that. And if there's a smoother texture to it, more glistening texture, I tend to think bacteria. I like to see the context in which I'm seeing this in, though. There are exceptions to both of those.
You agree, Dr. Handelsman?
Yep, that's a pretty good division.
You know, when that famous bacteria experiment or non-experiment was done about, discovering bacteria, penicillium, it was that there was something growing on the dish that was killing other things around it.
Yes.
Is that a good clue that you've got a bacteria growing there?
No, not necessarily. It's true that they can be very defensive against each other, but I wouldn't necessarily look for that as my criterion.
Mm-hmm. Because, in fact, penicillin is produced by penicillium mold,
right.
And it was a mold contaminant on the plate that led to the discovery of penicillin. So that's unfortunately not a good division, because bacteria and fungi both produce antibiotics.
Right.
All right. 1-800-989-8255. John in St. George, Utah. Hi, John.
Hi. It sounds like you're currently starting just a little bit to lead to the area of my question. First of all, the lady mentioned that there are various colored hues one can look for. My question is this. I've always heard that bacterium are extremely small, and yet there may be just a few that are visible individually to the human eye. Is that true? And if so, what percentage or which ones are visible to the human eye, unaided by a lens of any kind?
Well, I was pleasantly surprised when I was working on the field guides that I was able to show visible visible is not quite macroscopic field marks for all of the major groups of bacteria except for one. It depends on where you go. You need to see them in context. You're not necessarily going to be able to go on one field trip and see all of the major groups, but I was amazed at how visible they are when they're in their ideal habitats. For example, the sulfur bacteria in the presence of lots of sulfur.
But now are you talking about conglomerations or one individual bacteria, one at a time?
You're talking about a bacterium. Can you see one little cell there?
Yes.
There are actually some interesting examples of enormous bacteria. One of them is found in the gut of a particular fish called the surgeon fish. And when I say enormous, I mean that it looks like perhaps on the head of a pin, a tiny morsel of moisture, and that would be a huge bacterium. There is a sulfur bacterium that fills itself up with its waste products and makes an enormous pearl-like droplet. But again, you could put several of these on the head of a pin, so we're still talking about something that's tiny. So if you're talking about an individual cell, there are some surprisingly enormous bacterial cells.
Thanks, John. Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Dr. Handelsman, let's talk a bit about metagenomics a little bit more here. How successful is your prospecting when you sift through the soil you bring back to your lab and you find the genomes for these bacteria? How successful is it to make anything useful out of all these millions and billions of bacteria you're bringing back?
Well, the technology of metagenomics is still quite young. I think the whole field is in its infancy. So I don't think we have an answer to your question, but we have a few hints. What we know is that when we extract DNA directly from soil, so that's really as simple as it sounds, a bucket of soil being extracted directly, getting it then cleaned up to work with in the lab is hard, but it really is taking the bulk soil and getting all of the DNA from it, thereby accessing all of the bacteria in there, whether we can culture them or not.
Mm-hmm.
Using that method, we found that most of the genes are new. Now, they don't necessarily encode completely new functions, but they're sequences or variants on sequences that we haven't seen before. So that says that there is a lot of newness out there, biologically speaking, which bodes well for discovery. The challenge is screening through all of the clones that we get carrying these fragments of DNA from the soil, and in some cases we have 3 or 4 million clones to search through, and we've only started. That's just representing a tiny little percentage of the soil community. So the challenge is sorting through them and finding which ones produce something interesting. But what we found so far is that most of the antibiotics that have been discovered by this means are new. Now, they're not moving directly into application to humans because they don't seem to be that useful themselves. But that's not really discouraging because in the production of antibiotics from the cultured organisms, many of those also weren't useful. It was the small minority that were useful. So we're encouraged that we're finding new antibiotics, and now the question is, can we find a lot of new antibiotics so that we might find one that's very useful in humans?
And how big, how many people like you do this kind of research? Is this a large industry or just people in labs scattered around the world, do you think?
It seems to be pretty limited, and I think that many scientific groups, both in industry and in academic labs, are kind of waiting to see what happens before they jump in. Many people are cloning directly from environments. There's some wonderful work going on in the ocean, in acid mines, in all sorts of different environments. It's not just limited to the soil. And people are sequencing the genes. What is moving a lot more slowly is screening for new functions like antibiotics, and there are only a few labs doing that I know of.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about bacteria this hour in Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Would you guess that most of the bacteria we know about are the minor parts, the minor number that exist in the world, that there's so many more out there than we know about?
Yes.
Oh,
absolutely. I concur. I know Dr. Handelman is about to agree
way. Does that mean billions or trillions more versus what we know about? 1,000 to 1, a billion, a trillion?
Well,
I'm sorry.
Or can you not quantify it?
One of the problems is we don't have enough information to predict it. A scientist in my lab has been trying just in the last few months to make those predictions.
Yeah.
And what he's discovered is we're so close to the beginning of the search that we can't even predict where it will go. And so, you know, many people have estimated that it would be maybe 1,000 times more species than we know about now. But we think that those are pretty shaky estimates because we don't know what the shape of the collecting curve will be.
From what you know, and considering how many different and varied species there are and how tough they are, would you be surprised if there are not bacteria on maybe Mars or the moons of Jupiter or under the oceans there and some of those moons? Would it be surprising if we don't find something?
I would be surprised if we did, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I think that bacteria are what we should be looking for. I think people who are doing extraterrestrial biology ought to be gearing themselves as much as possible to some of our more extreme bacteria on Earth and trying to understand those in hopes of maybe discovering them elsewhere. I think Mars will be a real surprise for me. I have greater hopes for some of the planets where we know there's something going on under the surface of the crust, such that the planet is not as cold as it actually appears to be, that there's maybe some real warmth inside, in which case maybe there's something thermophilic.
Europa and the moon of Jupiter?
Yeah.
Dr. Handelsman, you agree?
I would agree with that. Mars is a pretty hostile environment for bacteria, at least the bacteria that we know on Earth. But we've been so wrong so many times as bacteriologists because bacteria just keep outsmarting us, that I wouldn't be surprised if there's a new kind of life that we haven't even imagined. And I expect it would be bacterial, but it might be a very different kind of bacteria.
And the hunt will continue on this planet for new kinds of bacteria.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we feel that it's just as exciting to go into our backyards and dig up some soil or go into the gut of an insect and determine the microbes that are there as it is to go to Mars. I mean, the variety and the newness of the bacterial life on Earth is just so staggering that there's a lot of work to be done without going very far from home.
And Betsy, it's a lot cheaper to take a field trip to these bacteria than going to Mars.
Yes.
And I got about 30 seconds. Any last field trip suggestions for us?
Yes, I think everyone should make a pilgrimage to Yellowstone National Park. Everyone who's bacteriophilic or bacteriocentric, two words I'm trying to make popular through my book. Yellowstone National Park is beautifully laid out for maximal accessibility of all of the hot spring bacteria. Lovely boardwalks. You can get close, but not too close. And see a huge array of thermophilic bacteria. It's a great field trip, I think.
All right, I'm ready to sign up. Dr. Dyer, last.
I was going to recommend looking at your shower curtain. There was a paper that just came out that's gotten a lot of press this week about the pink bacteria that live at the bottom of the shower curtain, and they're very interesting organisms. So I recommend looking at the
shower.
Should we
put them on a Petri dish, or is that a little dangerous?
Absolutely.
I'm afraid to go near my shower curtain. And there you have it. You can try this at home this weekend. Okay, we finally found something to do. I want to thank both my guests, Betsy Dexter Dyer, the Boyan Jennings Professor of Biology at Wheaton College in Norton, Massachusetts, author of A Field Guide to Bacteria, out from Cornell University Press. A great book. Great gift. I highly recommend it, especially for the spring coming up here. And Joe Handelsman, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute Professor of Plant Pathology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Thank you for taking time to talk with us this hour.
Thank you very much.
Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello here in New York, and Tom Martin Erickson in Madison. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Finn. If you want to send us email, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is there. You can also sign up for Science Friday and take it away on your iPod and your Audible player, or any of the other kinds of players that do Audible, or listen to it on Real Audio. Have a great weekend. Get out there and search for some bacteria. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.